Internet Talk Radio, Flame of the Internet.
This is Geek of the Week. We're talking to Don Hoffman. He's a senior staff engineer at Sun Microsystems. Welcome to Geek of the Week, Don.
Thanks.
You're in the Advanced Multimedia Networking Group at Sun, and I understand you're in the process of building a laboratory to deploy multimedia for yourself. You're trying to bring some technology out of the research labs and begin using it within Sun. Could you?
Yeah, a lot of what's happening is certainly people have been making extensive use of tools like NV and VAD on MBone. And there's some limitations to the internet environment there where we'd like to say do higher quality video or a lot more audio, but we've run into recently saying with a lot of people doing video, it's starting to put a lot of pressure on the capacity of the internet. These sort of limitations you don't run into in, say, a campus network environment where we have hundreds of megabits of bandwidth running from one end of campus to the other and between, say, campuses here in the Bay Area. So what we're trying to do is take a lot of the technology that's already available in the internet world and bring it into the corporate internet environment.
So what do you have in mind? What do you view your own personal computing environment looking like in a year?
Well, there's really sort of, from our point of view, there's really, I see two main applications. Actually, one of them tends to be sort of a one-to-many application. You know, in the internet world, you sort of see the IETF broadcast of taking all the various IETF working groups and sending them out into the internet. Here, for instance, we can do similar things. We can take seminars that are being offered, say, by the SunU group. We can take, say, satellite. One of the things we have is we have connected to a standard satellite broadcast receiver, and then we can now rebroadcast this on the internal engineering network.
Now, doesn't that take a lot of work? I mean, producing TV is not a simple thing
to do. But that's the point. Right now we're taking either things that were already produced, like, for instance, the SunU people have already put together course material.
SunU is the
internal training,
yeah.
Both for internal people and also for people, say, from outside of Sun who want to come in and get some training about Sun technology. And so they've already produced a lecture series. Somebody who's used to speaking in front of a large audience, they already have prepared materials. It turns out to be not very difficult to take that and just put a camera and some networking infrastructure in the room and redistribute that around the Sun network.
Now, that's just TV on a network. I mean, you could have used a coaxial cable, an internal cable system to do that. Why would you run that on a computer network instead of using cheaper technology?
Well, in our case, it actually isn't cheaper. We would have had to. The idea is here to get to everybody's desktop, this seminar, for instance. We would have had to put into everybody's office an additional parallel network, another TV, another CRT, more stuff on the desk. Instead, what we have is we can use the existing network and the existing workstations. So our goal here is to not, say, require, say, an additional add-on card on the desktop that you're using to view that, but whether we can run it on a standard Sun workstation, software-only decompression, I mean, much like we're doing with NV today. And so what you see then is I can take any workstation and down the hall here, we could walk up to, and I can now show you, say, CNN, where we're picking up off the satellite antenna. The same sort of technology would be used, for instance, for this SunU class.
Okay, so you hook up your local training facility with some video broadcasting equipment.
So
you have a satellite dish on the roof.
We have a lot of different sort of feeds we can use. The SunU, we have one of the groups here is Human Interface Group is setting up a special studio so that the SunU SunU people can go in and produce, take their standard stuff and produce, present it in that studio. One of the things you run into, I think a lot of experience we've got from, say, the IETF broadcast, is that lighting and the training of the cameraman makes a lot of difference. Bad lighting, you know, people can't see the slides on the camera. One sort of annoying thing that often happens in a lot of the IETF broadcasts is the camera person is panning back and forth between the speaker and say, somebody asking a question in the audience. And the nature of the compression algorithms causes the image to break up really badly. And so by having trained camera operators and rooms where you can sort of do cuts between cameras, we can improve the quality of the presentation.
Now, this means you have to hire trained camera operators and lighting technicians. Is this the kind of employee that Sun has to hire now to do this?
Well, generally, you do need to have, we've always needed to have somebody trained in operating the cameras because if for another reason than High-end cameras are rather complicated to operate. You know, it's not like a Sony mini camera, you just go plug it in. And so really always, the additional training for that person is probably not that great. The room as for the presentations is fairly, it's been set up ahead of time, and so the lighting tends to be fairly static. We don't need to redo the lighting for every presentation. It tends to stay the same way. So there's a fixed lectern, fixed lighting.
When we hear of video conferencing on computer networks and when we hear of things like Internet talk radio, mm-hmm. A lot of the press looks at it and says, this is bringing the technology to the masses. This is personal broadcasting.
Right.
And what I'm hearing here is that if you're going to do video and you don't want it to look like a home movie, it's not the kind of thing that you slap together in 2 seconds and you're a TV station broadcasting to the world. It's just as complicated in the computer world as it is in the
And absolutely.
Media
in fact, there's a lot of, I think, parallel with other ways of communication. When easy ways to prepare graphic slides became available, there were a lot of bad slides and a lot of, you know, desktop publishing became possible and there was a lot of really bad newsletters. And as people gained experience, they started becoming sort of literate in the style of doing, say, desktop publishing and preparing newsletters that actually look good. And I think we'll see the same thing on the video side, that right now, you know, the standard way is you stick a camera down in front of the guy and he says what he's going to say. But people will start becoming more literate in the style of producing video material.
So you think just as people can now recognize a 150 dot per inch dot matrix
right.
Resume, they'll be able to recognize a home video 8mm poorly lit.
It wouldn't even be surprising that a lot of the college curricula in terms of communication would include how to produce videos. For you know, right now people learn how to write in college and they learn how to do presentations. Well, why shouldn't they learn how to do videos also?
Don Hoffman, we've been looking a lot at multimedia networks. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the effect of multimedia on a computer network. Do we have to do things differently on the network, or is this just more bandwidth and faster processors?
Well, in fact, it actually turns out to be all of the above. And it's generally in the case in computing that you find fix one bottleneck and another one pops up. And so in order to do the things we're doing internally within Sun, we've had to do both. We've had to increase the bandwidth. So here, although the current generation of our backbone is an FTDI-based backbone, so we've increased the bandwidth a reasonable amount, but also we need to do smarter things. So for instance, our corporate internet is not all FTDI. So for instance, the final part of the network into my office is still Ethernet. So we need to sort of looking at, say, smarter mechanisms, say the router between the FTDI network and the final leg, do things like resource management and bandwidth limitation.
Now, you have 10 megabits coming to your desktop, and you do a lot of video conferencing work. Is 10 megabits enough?
Barely.
Barely. Is 100 megabits enough?
100 megabits, for instance, right now, we're for the one-to-many style of video, 100 megabits is actually plenty. So here on campus, let's say even if we had half a dozen at any one time groups producing a one-to-many video show of some signal of some sort. An FTDI network, for instance, could probably handle that using, say, the current level of video we're able to do on a workstation. That is, say, less than 10 frames a second, 240 by 380 resolution.
Are we going to always want more bandwidth?
We're always going to want more bandwidth because what happens is I show this video to this quality of video to people that are, say, a little bit more video aware, such as the MPEG people, and they look at it and they just sort of, this is not video, this is, you know, toys or something like that. But it's still very useful. So for instance, for me to be able to stay in my office and see some sort of training module, that's useful to me, and so I'm not necessarily concerned about the quality of the video.
But at some point you'll get the quality you want. An HDTV stream is what, 20 megabits per second?
No, maybe probably a little bit more than that, depending on how much compression, right?
Would 600 megabits to the desktop be enough forever? I mean, are we going to continually want more bandwidth, or is there an end in sight?
I don't think there's ever going to be an end in sight, because then you start proposing things like virtual reality and that sort of thing. And I think it was, the idea is that, I think it was Norm Shriver at Bell Labs was talking about the idea of having drones you send out. So instead of actually going somewhere on vacation, you send out a drone. Well, imagine the sort of bandwidth you need to do that sort of thing.
A virtual vacation.
A virtual vacation, yeah. And, you know, there's a lot, and so you can always sort of say that, well.
That's an awful thought, you know.
Yeah, I know.
But it's like, we're unable to give you your vacation this week, Don, but we've allowed your computer to take one instead.
Well, but the thing is, you won't have to sit in the airplane for all that time, so.
And the computer would send you a postcard.
Right, exactly.
We've been looking a lot at multimedia technology again, and part of that is the underlying infrastructure of the network. You've talked about an FDDI backbone, and that's probably not enough for the future. Is ATM the technology that you've spotted as the one that's going to solve all our problems forever?
Well, there's some nice things about ATM. It isn't all there yet, and so if we took ATM that I could buy off the shelf today or even in the next year, I don't think it'll solve all our problems, but ATM offers the possibility, it offers a way that one could, a platform where one could solve a lot of the problems, say in the next 3 to 4 years.
But today, is it a wide area network? Is it something I could use for putting a virtual corporate backbone in place?
The main thing ATM offers today is the bigger pipe. And there's a lot of people doing research on congestion control and resource management in the network. And I think in order for ATM to be a complete solution, we're going to need to see that sort of work make its way into the products. So today, I can go to Synoptics and buy a switch, and it's very good fat pipe. It handles the LAN environment very well. Other vendors more on the telephony side are offering ATM switches that sort of deal with the wide area networking well.
Do you have to change your software in order to go, let's say, from an Ethernet to an ATM environment? Does ATM give you everything that Ethernet gives you?
Well, in fact, this is a big discussion in ATM forum about ATM LAN emulation, because there are a lot of features in sort of standard, the way we've seen LANs, they tend to be intrinsically broadcast and multicast-based media. And so, for instance, you'll see that, you know, in Ethernet, we can do something like multicast or broadcast. It's sort of standard. It's easy to do. In ATM, it's a bit more difficult. And so some of the problems we have right now is we've, at least in the Internet world, we've defined a certain model of multicast that works very well on the Internet wide area network and then on the final LANs like Ethernets and token rings. It's going to take a little bit more work to take that same approach and fit it into the ATM environment.
I mean, how do you do it? Do you set up a virtual circuit with everyone you're talking to strictly for each multicast address?
There's a lot of discussion on this. And there's really several ways the problem could be solved, and I don't think any one of them is the obvious winner right now. One is to say that, you change the multicast model. I mean, the current ATM ATM forum specifications have really the idea of more of a source control multicast, where the source sort of sets up the multicast group and decides who the members are.
So a PC wakes up on the network, is looking for its operating system from a remote server. It's got to have enough smarts to know the names of the servers ahead of time.
But if, let's say the PC comes up and wants to join a training class, they have to contact the broadcasting machine and say, add me to the group. So it's source control. Unlike, say, the IP multicast model that Steve Deering did with the receivers, just basically just joins the group. Doesn't have to ask permission from anybody. So that's the obvious way one would do it now when we're doing a multicast style of application on an ATM network. Other people are talking about having resequencer servers where the source is sending out packets to a resequencer and it's then redistributing it to all the people all of the stations that want to receive.
So a reflector of some sort.
It's some of the kinds of reflector. In which case, even then, so you really only have to go establish a relationship with the resequencer or reflector.
It's important to understand, of course, that multicasting is used not only as a way of joining a video conferencing group,
right.
but at very low layers for things like advertising services, and
it's
a very basic part of the LAN environment.
If you look at all the tools we have available on the internet today, they all really rely very heavily on multicast technology. And they require very heavily on the style of multicast technology available, the IP multicast available today. And so we're going to need to either rethink the basics of multicast, or we're going to need to basically make ATM emulate that. And so I think what Steve Deering said, that, well, ATM's only going to succeed if it actually supports the style of multicast that we have in the Internet today.
Now, the Internet multicasting is a wide area IP-level multicasting technology, which assumes, in order to work effectively, something at the local area network that's efficient for moving information out. Why, if you have IP multicasting in a wide area, why can't IP take care of those problems? Why does ATM, as a data link layer, as a wide area cloud, also have to do the same thing?
Well, one of the advantages given to ATM is that it lowers the barriers between the local area network and the wide area network. And so many people are proposing that, in fact, we try to have end-to-end ATM. And so I think there's a lot of discussion on this, whether we sort of say that the ATM network really becomes the Internet. And in fact, a lot of people even propose taking some of the technologies developed in the Internet and trying to move them down
exactly.
into the ATM fabric.
That was my question,
right.
if you've got multicasting at the ATM layer, why do we need IP at all? I mean, is the Internet going to go away and be replaced by an ATM cloud?
That's quite possible, not anytime soon, of course, but that would be the fantasy a lot of people, I think, would have, that by taking the functionality we have today on the Internet, moving it into the ATM network fabric, we'd get the advantages of end-to-end ATM, plus the flexibility of the Internet. Plus, since you are using Internet architecture, you have a much easier way for you to migrate between the two environments, because the problem now is if you sort of said, well, you're only going to use end-to-end ATM mechanisms, you'd cut out a lot of your current population, because it's going to be even for the next few years, it's going to be relatively expensive to get an ATM connection.
Is it realistic that we would ever get rid of
token
rings? And
well, I mean, it's not realistic in the next 10 years.
I mean, I could see putting an Ethernet connector on my home toaster, but I think ATM on my home toaster might be a little much.
Right, and so you're going to continue to need. That's what I'm saying. You continue to need the Internet approach, that which assumes some level of heterogeneity in your network. Now, a lot of the problem, though, is still a lot of the architecture, a lot of the work we're doing now assumes meshes that are not as fully connected as you might have, say, in an end-to-end ATM environment. So in an end-to-end ATM environment, you're going to have basically a virtual connection between every pair of communicators in sort of the simple model. And so it's a little bit different today, where I do at least a little bit of traffic aggregation. When I cross, say, some of so for instance, here in the Bay Area, all the Sun traffic goes through one link into Barnett. And so that really looks like one virtual, that's really just one virtual circuit from the point of view of Sun. Whereas if we were had end-to-end ATM fabric, now all of a sudden we're setting up virtual circuits willy-nilly all over the place, and now the whole issues of routing become very difficult. The whole issues of how do you set up a multicast group that's made up of thousands and thousands of virtual connections. It's not necessarily clear that what we're doing today is going to be able to transfer over to an end-to-end ATM environment without some major changes in the architecture.
Developer of software for your base platform, basically the network is now part of the operating system. How do you choose which of the things from the research world or from the public domain world actually get implemented in your core software?
Well, Well, that's actually really hard to do. And so what you see a lot of times is we start a lot of efforts. We start a lot of efforts and to get them to the prototype stage. And when it comes time to decide whether we make it into a product, we say, well, no, we don't. And I can't think of anything off the top of my head right now where we've said no. But I think an example is that in some cases we've actually taken things all the way to products and they haven't actually succeeded as much as we might expect. Early days, I actually started out at Sun developing OSI software. And in some sense, we probably spent as much engineering effort implementing OSI software as we did on the internet stack, because we had a little bit easier because we were using a Berkeley software base. We got a lot of the internet networking software essentially for free, and most of our effort was optimizing it for the Sun platform, bug fixes, that sort of thing. And so we had an engineering team actually larger than the internet team in developing OSI software. And we actually took all that through taking some early research work. This would be in the early 80s, taking some research work from BBN, moving it over to the Sun platform, adding some additional stuff of our own, actually sent it out to product, and yet we found that it never really sold the way we expected it to.
Have you tried giving it away?
Well, in fact, a good sales rep often will arrange things that way where the cost of the software is hidden in the overall cost of the deal. And so from the point of view of the customer, it appears that it's being given away.
Was OSI really hard to implement? I know that's a softball question, but...
No, actually, it was not very hard to implement. I think in any protocol, it's always easy to sort of get something basically running. And there's nothing particularly difficult about, say, OS session and layer and below. Now, I wouldn't say the same thing about some of the application layers protocols. I think anybody that's tried to implement an ASN1 encoder and decoder knows that that's not necessarily a simple thing to do. But say that CLNP is actually very straightforward. I actually did the actual coding in probably less than a week. That was, of course, starting from the Berkeley IP implementation using essentially the same approach and just changing the... It's really not that many differences, and so the implementation was actually fairly quick.
If it's so straightforward, why aren't we looking more seriously? I know some people are, but there's the division in the Internet and the use of the connectionless network services, the next generation IP, and if it's such an easy change in the code, why isn't there a real strong movement saying, gee, just give us 2x, it gives us bigger addresses and it's an easy upgrade?
Well, historically, a lot of the difficulty came from the fact that, at least in CLNP, the addressing was too flexible. And so we spent a lot of effort in trying to come up with mechanisms that would... We're a platform vendor, number one, and so we have to provide a platform that can support all the likely addressing mechanisms that somebody would want to use in CLNP. Well, at least at the time we're talking about, mid to early 80s, there was not quite this... We didn't have something like ITF who could have said, well, there's this one address format that you need to support. So in that case, it was just difficult to put together an OSI network because you really had to be you really had to design your own addressing approach.
But even today, Sun, for example, is one of the leaders in the SIP effort for a new generation IP. You've put all this money into doing your CLNS implementations. Why in the world are you inventing a new IP when you could have reused this ISO code that's still sitting around that all these engineers developed?
Well, I mean, a lot of it was that there weren't really any advantages. At least in the technology we're looking at, there weren't really any real advantages to CUSIS to go through all the... other than sort of more flexible addressing, we didn't see a whole lot of advantages to CLNP, and neither did a lot of our customers. Why move over from a perfectly functional and robust networking platform to something else that didn't really give you any advantages? So, for instance, why move over to X400 when you had something like SMTP-based mail? I mean, it worked perfectly well. What was the motivation? And I think what we see today is that in the case of SIP, there's actually some new concepts in there, some simplifications. And instead of making things more complicated, we made things simpler. I think that's one of the things we realized, that at least below a certain layer in the protocol abstraction, simplicity is better.
There's a risk approach to networking.
The risk approach to networking. And I think that's been a lot of what's driven SIP, is to try to sort of take some things that were simple. Now, you can do, of course, CLNP, you can do everything in the world, but it's not necessarily the case that it's simple to do. And so I think you see SIP sort of saying, well, what are the top 80% of things we want to accomplish? Let's make those very, very easy to do. And other things become the last 20% become more difficult. Whereas a CLNP approach, nothing is really particularly difficult. There's a lot of things you can do, but on the other hand, nothing is like trivially easy. And so I think the idea of it is the risk approach of sort of taking the functions you use the most and making those the simplest.
So at the lower layers, we're looking at simplicity. What about the upper layers? Do we need a richer development environment on the internet? Should there be object-oriented inheritance class support built in somehow in a presentation layer?
Well, that in fact is what's driving a lot yes, I think so. In fact, but I think you need to hide those behind toolkits. We're seeing that today in the multimedia world, where today it's quite possible to write a multimedia application that runs an existing. You can sit down, Ron Fredericks and Van Jacobsen have both done excellent tools in very wide use. But it's not trivial to do, and it takes somebody of a very high caliber to put together an application of that sort. And so I think there's a need. But how does one of the problems we have in the software world is finding people to write all the applications that we need. And you can't do that if you have to be intimately aware of how the multicast packets behave and on your own deal with the issues of quality of service and synchronization. And so, at least from Sun's point of view, as a platform vendor, we need to put together higher level toolkits that make it easier for more conventional application programmers to develop distributed multimedia applications. And so a lot of Sun's effort these days has been into trying to come up with appropriate toolkits that allow you to do that sort of thing without being a expert in multimedia or networking.
Give me an example of what a toolkit might do for me as an application programmer.
Well, today, for instance, an example would be today to write a tool, say something like a video tool of some sort, similar to Envy, what you need to do is, first you need to be fairly aware of the way that the frame grabber operates. And so Envy grabs frames directly off of the, in the case of the Sun platform, the VideoPix device driver. So you have to be intimately aware of the way the device driver works, some of the timing aspects of the device driver, and the data format, YUV and all that sort of color spaces and things like that. You now have to now come up with some sort of your own packetization and compression algorithm and write the code to do that. You then have to actually on your own now encapsulate that and maintain some sort of a network transport stream.
Sounds like a nice senior class project.
Well, in fact, I think it's probably a fairly common graduate student project these days. But the same thing again, we'd like to make it much easier. So for instance, our goal would be to say that you have an abstract object that's a frame grabber or a compression device. And you basically say, grab me a video stream off of here and push it out the network. And so really, writing the application really consists of instantiating two objects, a frame grabber object and, say, some sort of a network endpoint object, and just connecting the two together and saying, off you go. Now, that's a much easier conceptual model, you do that and say, well, that's hard to implement. Yeah, and it's still, I think, something that remains to be seen is whether we'll be able to actually get, say, the performance level we need.
Does that lead to programmers writing things that are not network aware because it's just too easy to grab a toolkit?
Well, in fact, they are. What we're trying to do is say the toolkit. Well, I think an example of that is maybe not a good example, but we'll start with the idea of the X environment, X Windows environment, where there's really no real. You can write applications that are at least somewhat distributed without any real awareness of the network, and so. If you're writing to XLive, well, it's kind of a low level. But if you look at a toolkit like TK or XView, something like that, much higher level of abstraction. And so you're really not aware of the network. The same thing here is we'd like to say that, well, you're aware of the network, but it's in a more of an abstract sense. The idea that I'm going to attach a video display object on my system to a video capture object on your system. That's still intrinsically networked, but at least at conceptual level, I'm not having to worry about the details of what exactly is the representation across the wire. How do I schedule the packets on the workstation or across the network?
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking to Don Hoffman, and this has been Geek of the Week. You've been listening to Geek of the Week, a production of the Internet Multicasting Service.
to purchase an audio cassette of this program, send mail to audio@ora.com. You may copy this file and change the encoding format, but may not resell the contents or make a derivative work. Support for Geek of the Week comes from Sun Microsystems, makers of open system solutions. Sun, when you think geek, think Sun. Support for Geek of the Week also comes from O'Reilly & Associates. O'Reilly & Associates, publishers of the Global Network Navigator. Send mail to info@gnn.com for more information. Network connectivity for the Internet Multicasting Service is provided by UUNet Technologies and by MFS DataNet. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, town crier to the Global Village.